Welcome to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. On this show, we attempt to understand the connection between the artist, the art, and the life as it is lived. The subject, the object, and the verb. It's a new year, and we're bringing you a new format. Unlike last season's essayistic approach, where we gathered together different artists, this year we'll be using each episode to focus on a single artist's work. And instead of seasonally, we'll be releasing an episode every month. But as ever, sound remains a central concept to this show, and today's episode features Lawrence Abu Hamdan, an artist who doesn't simply use sound, but considers it as a material able to express the undulating fabric of our society. I met Abu Hamdan in 2017 in the United Arab Emirates. We were both exhibiting at the Sharjah Biennial, and Abu Hamdan was showing a sound work called Sednaya, The Missing 19 dB, which sonically illustrated the way silence was used as a punishment in a Syrian torture prison. The piece was made in collaboration with Amnesty International and Forensic Architecture, and like much of Abu Hamdan's work, it used sound as a means to understanding larger political situations. During the biennial, Abu Hamdan also gave a lecture on the ShotSpotter technology, which is used to detect gunshots around American cities. With crime as an excuse, microphones were placed all around urban neighborhoods, allowing for new and possibly invasive forms of surveillance. Abu Hamdan refers to himself as a private ear, or ear witness, developing his sensitivity to the nuances of sound in a world that otherwise focuses on vision. The work that results occupies a place somewhere between sound art, documentary, and investigative radio journalism. For this episode, Abu Hamdan spoke with Sabi Ahmad, a curator at Ashara Art Foundation in Dubai, who focuses on the contemporary art of South Asia. In the following conversation, Ahmad asked Abu Hamdan about his sonic library of sounds, which he has been amassing for years. While Ahmad asked the questions, Abu Hamdan performed his recordings, demonstrating the ways in which sounds can defy the ear and the complex narratives that might be contained in even the most unassuming sounds.
This place that you call your studio, is this your studio? Are there many studios? Is there a place that is the archive that is separate from the studio? Do they all transform into one another based on what your necessities are? How does it work? This entire apparatus and the space and that object that you brought here, as opposed to all the other objects that are sitting in Beirut.
Yeah, so like I think a lot of people, the question of where the practice sits is now kind of like dissipated globally. Just like the inventory itself, right? That I try to make sure that there's a very diverse source of sounds, and that in some way become a kind of bibliography or discography for thinking and grouping and researching and making kind of arguments But basically, so you have here a kind of a popcorn maker, which is made from the description of a hotel collapsing into a sinkhole in Florida. Someone said it sounded just like popcorn, but I didn't smell popcorn. So if you hear popcorn but don't smell popcorn, because of course the smell is going to travel far further than the sound, so you know that there's something actually maybe perhaps structurally wrong with the building. You might be encountering a sinkhole, as this person did in Florida. So these are kind of strange little symptoms paths to a diagnosis also that we could start to find in other places, like in South Africa when a mine collapsed and the people who sat on top of the mine described it as sounding for days before the mine collapsed as the sound of wagon wheels on a dirt road. Again, a kind of diagnosis not of a symptom not of necessarily the mine collapsing in a way we could uncover that sound or beware of it, but also kind of understanding a certain type of settler colonial imagination that make you hear the sound of a mine collapsing as wagon wheels going on a dirt road in search of a kind of New Jerusalem. And this is taken precisely and stolen from this Rosalind Morris essay, which is called The Miner's Ear. So this collection of sounds is also trying to sort of form small little groups and affinities within of itself, and they start to speak together within of each other. And that's in a way, yeah, I guess how also that you could make a kind of diagram of the practice as such.
Yeah. And in this space, how many objects do you keep?
In this space, I keep one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I will get it for you now.
Mm-hmm. How do you annotate them is the question I'm going to ask afterwards, because each sound could have multiple associations too. Do you do it based on the witness that described it, or based on multiple witnesses that described them?
I mean, it doesn't. I mean, if I'm going to do this as a report, right? So this is the site where you would produce memory. And it's towards the production of a truth. This is not actually gathering, in a way, evidence. This is towards and in dialogue always with a witness, right? That's the idea. Even if that witness is just somebody who shows up in a gallery and hears or sees the objects, right? There's still the kind of activation of a sonic imagination has to happen. It's never just a collection of evidence, of acoustic evidence. It's things which will or could produce, yeah. And so last time, actually, I was doing something similar to this, talking about the ear witness inventory. I was given this tripod adapter. The cameraman, it was filmed for German TV, and the cameraman immediately afterwards, we were in Beirut, and they'd hired a local camera guy, and immediately afterwards he came up to me after hearing my interview, and he brandished the top of this tripod adapter. I don't actually know what it's called. I need to find out the exact name for it. It makes this sound. Stop these other sounds. This is the sound it makes. And he recounted for me a moment when years earlier he was a cameraman while there was an interview of the former Lebanese president Amir Lahoud. And it was one of his first jobs. And immediately after the interview, he released the tripod. And a kind of reaction started happening in the room. Immediately, his security swung around. He was accosted. And before he knew what was going on, he was planted on the ground. His arm was thrust behind his back almost to the point of breaking. And he had no idea what had happened. And of course, this sound for him was just part of his professional world, but for the security it was the exact sound of somebody cocking back a gun and be about to assassinate the president. And so he gave me this as a kind of way of adding to my inventory. And so you see that it's also kind of has multiple ways of accumulating.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really treasure this object, and that's why it's the only one in my studio, because it was kind of gifted to me. And the story is one very much of what you speak of, the kind of multiple witnesses to the same sound.
Right.
And that's where it sits in
the life. And so when this goes into your inventory and archive, and at what point does noise become an encoded sound in your sound effects library? Is there a distinction
between noise,
yes,
and
annotated sound? Do you even work with that distinction, is my question.
No, I don't think I do. I think there is a question of things being distortion rather than noise is important. Mm. And I think trying to hear distortions as sometimes significant, sometimes insignificant, is really also part of this. So, you know, knowing, for example, that, you know, let me think of a good example. I mean, there's this sound. I'll play it for you now. Wait one second. Oh no, I don't have it here actually. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not this sound. But we have this sound in the background. Mm-hmm. So, like, the question of distortion rather than noise is important. And I will just recount a story that happened to me during the Segnaya interviews. There was a guy, he's called Samer, and we were looking through the BBC archive to find the sound of the main door that would close the wing of his unit. We kept playing door sounds, and it was really important to get this door sound right, because I needed to understand exactly where he was in relation to this door. If we could know how often that door was being opened, we could tell a kind of systematization of when the guards could come in. We could tell how many prisoners were being brought in regularly, all this kind of thing, right? Because don't forget, we're in an otherwise brutally enforced condition of silence. Prisoners cannot make sound or voice, right? So you don't hear people coming in. You might hear pads of their footsteps. You might hear other things, but the doors really punctuate the prison. So it was really important to understand where he was in relation to this main door. And he kept telling me, it's louder, it's louder, keep playing louder. And I was getting these huge door sounds, ridiculous. And I kept putting the reverb up, and he was saying, oh, it's bigger, it's a bigger sound. And at some point it became the sound of like Notre Dame Cathedral. I was putting the reverb to Notre Dame Cathedral, and it sounded like a car crash happening inside Notre Dame Cathedral. No door could ever make this sound. And then he stopped me, he said, that's it. I said, that's it? You know, in a kind of suspicious way. He said, that's it, but that's not the door sound. That sound, he said, was exactly in Segnaya. I said, well, what was it? He said, that's the sound of when they would drop packs of bread on the ground outside our cell door. So it's not even that it's the door sound that we started looking for. We ended up with bread.
Right.
And that would happen constantly throughout those interviews. When you realize you're talking about sound, you start talking about hunger. And you start understanding that in states of extreme hunger, you start to hear things like bread sounding like a car crash. And then you start to be able to measure hunger slightly differently. It starts to work cross-sensory. You start to hear hunger. And then for the first time, I understood hunger. I don't think I really understood. I mean, I don't think I understand it now, but I got closer to it with that sound. But that sound is a kind of impossibility. I mean, it's not an impossibility to him. It's an extreme reality. It was something he lived through. But to you or I, it's completely impossible. To the laws of physics, it's impossible. In which, you know, I then did. You know, I went and like I said before, in the pursuit of the actual sound, try to get the bread. And I will just try and find where that is. Here. This is it. So I tried as many different packs of bread as I could to see just how loud that could be, that sound. But it never got to the car crash in Notre Dame Cathedral. No matter if I dropped 20 packs of bread. So I think that's what I mean by distortion rather than noise. And perceptual distortion, I think, is a really important way of understanding the way we're encoding and thinking sound sonically. Mm.
And so, is there ever a distinction made between subjective and objective approximations in such a process?
I think the attempt is always objective. The result is quite usually subjective. Mm. But I think if I were to just begin with the idea that everything would be subjective, I don't think this would be a relevant project. Mm. But I think arriving at the particular forms of subjection and subjectivity that you get to by pursuing a kind of, let's say, objective path, that's where some of the kind of lucidity happens for me.
And in a way, you're subjected to objects, you're subjected to events, you're subjected to effects that I think you're trying to register and encode here.
Exactly. Exactly.
How often is your studio reverberating with sounds from your library? Or is it mostly on earphones? I mean, I'm just trying to understand the way this apparatus works as you enter. Is there rhythm? Is there routine? Is there a way things are tested, tried, procedures marked out?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's much more concerned with the kind of performance of the archive, the activating of it in the sonic imagination of listeners. It's lying dormant until another case like Saidnaya would emerge, at which point I would be much more prepared than I was for the original case now. I feel like I'm armed with this thing. It's more in my pocket than in my studio, if you see what I mean. It's not really something that's making a constant noise here or that I'm working on constantly, but it's something that I arm myself with and try to use it as a kind of almost as a kind of source material, like I said before, as a kind of bibliography or like a discography. Doors are always very important because they punctuate crime scenes.
Is there a category of doors broadly within?
I've made a series of doors. There's a few objects within the archive that are actually custom built, and those are doors. So I made a kind of car door instrument, which is encased in a kind of wooden resonator. I made a kind of wooden box door, which has a kind of conical end, and that has a whole series of locks on the outside. And I made a metal door, which has kind of a slide function, like a kind of garage door. They're all very portable. The idea is that you could kind of magnify these sounds in the studio or in the post-production or with mics, but you need them to be also kind of portable and storable. Mm. But doors are very important. They were very important in the Saidnaya investigation. They're very important historically if you look at the ways in which ear witness testimony has been spoken about.
Mm.
In the O.J. Simpson trial, for example, everybody tries to time the sound they heard, the car door slam, right? Someone was brushing their teeth, so it must have been 9:17 p.m. Someone else was looking at they had a restaurant receipt, and they looked at the time and compared it to the time that they left the restaurant, etc. So they're really kind of punctuating devices. And that's another thing I wanted to just say, is that it sounds like this is a very kind of niche activity. And this is also kind of responding to the question of how often does these sounds resonate. But actually, ear witness testimony is the most prevalent source of testimony. It's the least understood. It's the least valued in some respects. Police and investigators give not very much time to understanding how people are describing sounds. But it's the most common because it's the one that's kind of usually spreads faster, right? And we have to really be directed at something to become an eyewitness. But we can just have had the window open or even not open, maybe through the window, through the wall, for us to become part of a kind of crime scene.
It reminds me actually of something Paul Virilio had written many years ago about a triad between the subject, the object, and the traject, meaning the trajectory in which either of these, and particularly an object, might travel. And this was, of course, crucial in media studies, as well as in studies around the advent of information technology, as well as ballistics, to study the trajectory of an object and estimate where it can be intercepted, maybe. what everything you've said so far brings to my mind is an idea, as I was mentioning earlier, that an object occurs, that an object happens, an object practically being like an event, but also the trajectory of an object in terms of what it's emanating, because everything is vibrating, as we know. Everything is emanating sounds. Maybe it's just tuned in such a way that they sort of resonate or have a singing frequency together, maybe. But then, one way or another, everything is emitting. Everything is happening. Mm-hmm. Objects are happening. And this is only a matter of which ones emanate with which intensity and which others emanate with lesser intensity.
Exactly. And, yeah, I mean, I think also, you know, in relation to your previous point about the ways in which literature has magnified sounds, right? The clenching of the teeth,
the popping of ears.
You know, cinema does exactly the same thing, right? The cigarette drag. Mm. It's a classic. No one I know has ever heard someone take it. The embers burn on the end of a cigarette. I've never heard it, but in every film I've seen where someone takes a drag, I hear loud as hell the embers of the end of the cigarette burning, right? Crackling. So, yeah, exactly. So, like, these kind of sounds that, yeah, they're not actually sounds, right? They're not, it's not about sound. It's about something else. I'm not sure, you know, in each case we would say it's about whatever it's about. Mm. Like, the other way, you know, you speak about this cross lines, how when sound started to speak about hunger, it was nothing to do with sound. We're in another kind of type of logarithmic measurement. And you know, it is interesting that so much of that informs our way of thinking about sound and violence. And I come back to cinema and how much, you know, violence is done to vegetables and stuff like that, right? Which actually give us a strange feeling about what it is that we're hearing, right? Like, what violence sounds like for those privileged enough not to have actually heard the real thing. We don't know that it doesn't sound like vegetables and watermelons. And so, you know, there's something I speak about in the inventory, which is about the ways that in wildlife documentaries, you know, you have this constant sort of what do you call that when you humanize an animal?
Anthropomorphize
animals through sound, right? So every step is heard. The polar bear licks his paws, and you hear the kind of bristles of his hair being licked. These are all very weird sounds, you know. And you know, like an iguana walks, and it sounds like someone's wearing a pair of leather sweatpants or something, you know. So these very kind of like strange small sounds that are all put to work to in a kind of ideological way, actually, also. So it's not that I'm uncovering kind of the, you know, that this witness heard something wrong and then this was what this means. I think we're always being subjected to these kind of, the ideology of like mini sounds. And, you know, a very strange thing happened to me after the Saydnaya investigation. Oh, by the way, that's a watermelon being hit.
Right.
So some of the sounds in the library actually pertain to recording the kind of archetype of cinema, because I have to understand what it's not like. When someone got punched and it sounded like a cinder block, I have to have the watermelon, because the watermelon is how we hear.
Encoded,
yeah, how it's encoded in cinema.
Yeah.
So I have to have the kind of negative example. Good cinema uses green coconuts. Bad cinema, cheaper cinema, lower budget uses watermelons, right? Green coconuts much more kind of prized for its both fleshy exterior and hard kind of skull-like interior. So anyway, the point being, yeah, that there's been very strange moments where sound effects started to mean something different after I worked on this project. And I was watching a horrible show, ended very badly, Game of Thrones, but I was nevertheless addicted. And I heard the sound of a door shut, a cellar door shut, a kind of medieval cellar door. And immediately I had a sonic flashback. I was taken back to an interview with Diab. And Diab is one of the Saidnaya witnesses. And I'd actually played that exact stock sound for him. It was one of the library's sounds that I'd played that Game of Thrones had just lazily used as well, right? It's very kind of commonly. And it was the exact sound because we played it over and over again and I analyzed it and I heard it. And so immediately I was kind of taken back to that interview, right? And to the way that he then, at the end of that passage of and where we played that sound, which he brushed off as too theatrical. And he said that actually what happened to him, we were doing the interviews in Istanbul, he said, "Lawrence, come with me to this one place. I know, because I tried to rent an apartment in this building, the gate is exactly the sound of Saidnaya. If I take you there, I will play it to you. I tried to rent that apartment. As soon as I heard the gate, I ran off. I said, there's no way I can rent this place," after the years he'd been there, right? So these kind of strange layers of also kind of flashback, the Game of Thrones door, his flashback to the door of the opening. So there's this kind of like space where they constantly start activating memory. And like I said at the beginning, it's impossible to sometimes escape the sound effect from the sound that we're speaking about, from the real sound, if you want.
If you'd like to hear Saidnaya, the missing 19dB, I featured it on a podcast I produce called The Organist. But be warned, it's harrowing. If you want to send along any comments, words of wisdom, or politically insensitive remarks, you can direct your email to subjectobjectverb@artreview.com. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next month.